Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. Now, same as last year, we wanted to do a solid for everyone and put all our discussions from The Right Time Book Club in one place. That way, if you wanted to get to the book later or anything like that, you could. This year's edition was on Mike Freeman's Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero. Thought it turned out pretty well, so check it out. Ah, yes. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for The Right Time Book Club. This summer, the book that we are using is Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero by Mike Freeman. We're going to have Lanae O'Neill of The Undefeated to talk about the book at the end of the month. We'll have Mike Freeman himself to talk about the book in August. But first, we're going to talk about the first 100 pages or so of the book with ESPN's Howard Bryan. I almost said ESPN the magazine, but I guess that is not what it is no more.
Got two more months.
Okay, gotcha. I didn't say I didn't know the technicals on that. I didn't like fully read the memo in particular, but we talked on the phone the other day, and one thing you asked me was why I chose this book. And I told you, like, the reason that I did this was I think Jim Brown, I say when Jim Brown dies, we're going to have a hell of a time figuring out what exactly it is that we are going to say about him. And I thought that this book overall is a pretty level look at him that doesn't get too caught up in the mythology of Jim Brown at the expense of some of the things that aren't nearly as glamorous as what he was as a football player. But the first 100 pages, so we're really going through the 1950s on this. And I wonder for you, like, how much did you know about his experience at Syracuse before this book?
A lot of it was new. I remember the HBO documentary, Jim Brown, All-American?
Yeah.
I remember that. Also talking to Jim on a couple of occasions. But most of this was new, and it was placed in really good context. I thought that it was one of the values of doing this type of assignment is going back and realizing all that you don't know. And I obviously, you know, read Dave Zirin's Jim Brown book last year. But Jim Brown's a shadowy figure in a lot of ways. Jim, I don't think that there's ever been that one project, that one definitive project where you would go into this and just feel nailed down and feel like, okay, I got this, the way you would say like the David Marinus Vince Lombardi book or even the Richard Ben Kramer DiMaggio book. Jim Brown is a You're right. When the time comes, whenever you want to do some sort of retrospective on Jim Brown, it's never going to be easy.
Well, I found it interesting in this book. You know, of course, he was born in Georgia and then moved to Long Island. I think he said when he was 8 years old, he made the move up there. But one thing I find very interesting about him, and I think really does inform a lot of things that happen later with Jim Brown, is that he seems to have had what is an American rarity, which is an integrated childhood and adolescence.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I guess the best way to put it in reading those early pages about how Mike sort of sets up his childhood, he talks about St. Simon, where he's from down in Georgia, and then making that transition up to New York. And one of the tough things in retrospect, I mean, when you're reading these types of books, and obviously when you write books now, is that you try to read them, you know, can you read them as a reader? Or are you reading them, well, here's how I would have done it. And so it makes it difficult to sort of get a feel for the different nuances of the storytelling. But I always found myself somewhat skeptical of the Manhasset sections where they're talking about that, you know, we didn't have any racism here. I don't know why this town was different. And as an East Coaster, you know, who grew up in these types of communities where every community thinks they're different, the embedded racism in there is fascinating. But it was interesting that his memories of being in the South were so sharp as an 8-year-old, or when he was even, I think 6 or 7, he really spent most of the time there, and then by 8 he was gone. So he had both in a lot of ways. He had the childhood of the, you know, the East Coast, sort of Long Island integrated dynamic, but also he still had memories of the South too. So he got a pretty, even, you know, by the time he was a teenager, he had a pretty good shape of what America was kind of all about.
Yeah, and Freeman uses an example, which seemed to be a very formative story for Jim, about, you know, his mother working down south, or his grandmother, I can't remember which, but he goes there because the man that she worked for wanted to meet him because of, you know, his act, you know, everything that he pulled off. He said he went down there and that man shook his hand at the door and never let him in the house. And he was like, got it.
When I was reading that anecdote, I was like, okay, is he going to make him come around back? He didn't let him stand there at the front door. And so these customs are, the customs are so ingrained and they're so powerful, even when you try to have these heroic figures, and I know you want to get into Paul Brown, I'm sure, a little bit later, but even when you're looking at the Paul Brown character and how Paul Brown didn't have a racist bone in his body, or Paul Brown was one of the rare white men who, you know, who was willing to challenge the, you know, the segregation of the of both football leagues in the late 40s. And but still, that those customs and those attitudes inform everything. You can feel it.
I thought, I don't know if you've read Unforgivable Blackness on Jack Johnson, but he, but there's a story he talked about where Booker T. Washington was invited to the White House by Teddy Roosevelt, and he said he didn't respect that man. He said if he respected that, respected him when he had him there, he would have sat and had dinner with him. But he didn't sit and have dinner with him. Like, that's how you know that this was just window dressing. And you're right, when you talk about those customs, it is those little things like that that you stop and look at and be like, oh, okay, this actually isn't how you treat people.
No, exactly right. And this is how I'm treating you. So that's the thing where it's always when I read, I always take a look at a couple of things. One thing I always read when I'm reading fiction is how does the author describe black characters? And when I'm reading nonfiction, especially when I'm reading a biography like this one, I always take a look and see how the white particulars, the principles in the story, how they are describing the very environment that our protagonist, Jim Brown, is living in. And the gap is amazing. The gap, it's always very, very wide. And it shows you exactly the space between the black experience and the white experience, where you have the white coaches and you have the white people who are interviewed in there. It's almost like what game are you watching? These two experiences are lived so differently. And it's funny because you, as a writer and as a reader, you're asking yourself the question, is it the writer's responsibility to bridge that gap, or is the gap so obvious that it need not be spoken because you're reading it and you can sense it for yourself?
Yeah, no, this is like, and I have the same way as you were about the stories about Manhasset, where there's always something underlying, right? Like, there's always like it's hard to believe. But the thing about Jim is Jim always says this, that the most important men in his life have always been white men. You know, like, he, even though he is not.
That makes sense, though.
Yeah, but even still, though, he's not a starry-eyed dude about these sorts of things, and at no point was he in a position where he rewound and looked back at some of these men and be like, no, they was actually more messed up than I realized. No, he's riding with them to the end.
Yeah, he's riding with the individual. Yes. I'm talking about the individual's attitude about the region.
Got it.
And so, and absolutely, it makes perfect sense because these people are the ones who are in power. And it's not just the power dynamic, but anybody who's a kid, anybody who can remember with any sort of accuracy being a kid. We all know, especially boys, and especially boys playing sports, people who take an interest in your success, you remember them for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
People who take an interest in you actually becoming something, because we're so used to everybody telling you what you can't be, you remember those people who said, wait a minute, this one was actually encouraging to me. And I do believe in that regard that it's not hyperbolic, nor is it fiction, that these guys really did take an interest in them. But I think it's also multitasking. You take an interest in these individuals, but you're also not out there crusading, breaking down barriers and breaking down customs. You're living within the custom while taking an interest in this individual.
Right. And then after that, the Syracuse stuff is so fascinating to me, including the fact that Jim Brown got tricked into going to Syracuse.
Got tricked into even going there. Exactly. The Syracuse stuff to me was, so far, was really, really, really fascinating. It was the most dynamic stuff that I've gotten to so far. And part of the reason is because it goes back to this question that we're having about the writer responsibility, and I'm interested in hearing what Mike's got to say about this when you have him on, the writer responsibility of filling in the gap or just letting it speak for itself and letting the reader understand what they're reading. And this, the Syracuse stuff speaks directly to this entire question of how we set up sports. We set up sports as the meritocracy. We set up sports as the place where if my score beats your score, then racism doesn't matter. I'm faster than you. I win. You lose. We're straight. And we do this not just, you know, and we talked about this with the Heritage last year. We talk about this in language. We got to level the playing field. We talk about, it's embedded in our language. And sports has so much power, supposedly because of that, right? And yet you read this book and you see that, one, the coaches didn't want him. The coaches were as racist as anybody. They weren't welcoming to him. You find out and you recognize, if you really start taking a step back, that for all the talk about the meritocracy in sports, you've got quota systems throughout every single sport, whether we're talking basketball, where you're not supposed to have five black players on the court at the same time, where you talk about football, where you're not supposed to have more than 10 black guys on the team. Baseball was supposed to, you're only supposed to have two blacks, and you weren't supposed to have any black pitchers or black catchers. So it really does throw into stark contrast sort of the hypocrisy of all of it. That sports is no different. Sports is actually worse because sports is the one place where you can just get on the field and play. It's not going to be someplace different where you're in a boardroom and you've got to figure out all these different politics within a framework. Nah, it's me and you on the field, and they still have quotas in that.
Hold on, not just quotas. But you couldn't have an odd number of either race on the team,
because
then you'd have to have one, just one, mixed roommate pair on the road. Although I have to say this on that level, if I am running the team, man, I can't imagine what that drawing names out of hats is like to decide who's got to be the one to do it. You know what I mean? Like, I have to admit, I wouldn't want that problem either.
No. And now, or if you're the Brooklyn Dodgers with Jackie, you just call a writer, you get Wendell Smith and say, Wendell, we need you to room with Jackie.
Yes.
You know, or you find another one to go find somebody black to room with our black players.
No, they decided to keep it even. But yeah, so, mm-hmm. You know, Jim finds out that basically they took donations from the hometown to send him to Syracuse because the guy was like, look, if I get him in, they'll wind up giving him a scholarship. And that kind of sort of happened. But it's wild to read that and think about the very idea that it took a while to make football coaches come around on the idea of putting Jim Brown on the field.
And once again, what's it tell you? It goes back and it just lays waste. I don't care about the color of a man's skin. I just care if he can perform at the high level. Give me a break. Stop. Just stop it and stop making it seem like the coaches are somehow different. The coaches are the ones who are the worst ones because the coaches are the ones who weren't going to put you in position. They were going to be the ones who weren't going to let you play quarterback or center. And they were the ones who weren't going to let you play middle linebacker and all in safety and all the thinking positions. So It is informative reading this, especially where we're at right now, and it just shows you that so much of sports, that this whole idea of the meritorious sporting environment is complete.
Well, some of what's interesting about this, and I'm curious what you think about this, because I grew up around in a largely suburban area around a lot of white people. You grew up in an urban black environment, and part of what jumped out to me about the Syracuse years is there's something about when you go meet like new white people as a black person, right? Like when you start your childhood and you're dealing with people year after year after year that you know you're going to develop some familiar relationships with people. And it's not some like it transcends race sort of stuff, but you get people that actually know you. And then you get to this place out of nowhere where nobody knows you, and you're like, whoa, this feels a lot more like what I've been reading.
Exactly. It feels way different.
Right. And that's what that really jumped out to me about what's going on with Jim is like, I can look back at me growing up, and look, I went to school growing up in Waller County, Texas, which has been in the news at various points. You may recognize the town name. I don't look back at that negatively at all. Like, I don't have those kinds of stories and memories about me growing up. I moved to California when I was like 21, Southern California, and I was like, yo, why are these people crossing the street when I come around? You know, it was one of the most jarring things that had ever happened to me because my optimism was slowly dying, I guess is the way to put it. And it sounds like that's what happened to Jim.
Yeah, no doubt. And what ends up happening, you find people get tested. We all get tested. And for me growing up, you found that your white friends were the ones who got tested even more. Because, yeah, I always had my guard up when I was around white people, especially around new white people, because you never knew when they were going to change on you. You never knew when the shift was going to come. And as you got older, you could tell it was always when the alcohol started flowing, when the adults started drinking or whatever, here come the slurs, and you knew that things were starting to go a little dark, a little sideways. But it was, to me, it was always when we were in new environments around new white people where you saw your white friends. They were the ones who got all squirrely because they didn't want to be judged by being friends with you. They were the ones who were waiting to get, you know, to get all the slurs and to get attacked for even defending you, and you knew they weren't going to have your back because they didn't want to deal with the weight of that. But it's true. I think that when you're looking at the Syracuse years, the shock of the sentence that Mike had in there where he said something like that the racism was not the, you know, the, or the tolerance was not the same once you got beyond Manhasset town limits. It was sort of like, okay, on the one hand, you were like, well, that might be a little hyperbolic in the middle, thinking, okay, well, Manhasset wasn't all that what they thought it was. But it was also sort of that stark reminder that the minute you got within 10, 15, 20 feet of your personal surroundings, things were going to get real, real hostile.
Yeah, no. I want to talk about...
It didn't take much, you know what I mean?
Right.
So you just take... All you need to do is go a mile, like in Boston. It's definitely like that with Boston. In Boston, you go in the wrong neighborhood, all of a sudden it's like being in a foreign country.
Well, you know, people talk about this with St. Louis. Was it Del Mar Street? All you got to do is cross it.
Just cross it. That's the same in Boston.
The other side of the street. That's all it takes. Like, there's only one place in New York that I really feel that. It is when you go on the east side, when you go above 96th.
That's a magic line, absolutely.
Yeah, 96 is such a line. You're like, yo, how did that happen so fast?
How did that happen so fast? It's true. Well, and that used to be the magic line across the west side, too, is that the minute you crossed that line, the taxis wouldn't go above there.
Yes.
You know, that's why they had all the car services up in Harlem and everything else, because that was the magic number. You know, you stay below it, you were in Manhattan, you stay above it, and you were in Darktown.
Yeah, I got to say this, though. If there is a bright side to all the white folks moving into Harlem, it is a lot easier to get a cab. I remember 2007. Yeah, like 2007, it wasn't really happening, right? Mm-hmm. I moved here in 2017. It's like, oh, this, I don't even have to. They even got special ones for us. The green ones. Way to go.
The green ones, exactly.
Appreciate you, you know?
Mm-hmm. And they'll go up from Midtown.
Yes.
Because you could be in Midtown and say, yeah, I'm going to 135th. They're like, not in this car, you're not.
Yeah, I've never had anybody turn me down on location since I moved here. It's mm-hmm. definitely happened prior.
Yep.
No question.
No, but, no doubt.
Now, you mentioned Paul Brown a little bit earlier, and you are a baseball guy first and foremost. Here's what I wanted to bring up about Paul Brown that I think is just kind of a generally interesting thing, which is Paul Brown is a significant figure in the integration of professional football and in college football. We talk about what his time at Ohio State and everything else. But, like, baseball has leaned in on the idea that he played a role in the integration of America. Even though the NFL was integrated before baseball was, baseball meant something different. So Jackie Robinson means something different.
Sure.
And even if it's just, like, window dressing, the surface level stuff, baseball leans in on it. Basketball and football have never leaned in on their branch Rickies in that way.
They have not.
Like, Red Auerbach, who, you know, Red Auerbach and Paul Brown, both really famous coaches, somehow that's not the top line on their resumes when it had so much to do with their success.
Well, it depends on where you're from. If you're from Boston, where I am from, it was drilled into you that the Celtics were, you know, because Boston got called racist often. I was like, well, what about the Celtics? And everybody talked about the Celtics. It was like, that was Boston's number one shield. Well, Red Auerbach drafted Chuck Cooper, and Red Auerbach hired the first black coach, and Red Auerbach put five black players on the court at the same time. So what about Red? So for me, the Celtic legacy is part of growing up. I already knew it. We already knew that in Red. But you're absolutely right. It never went national. It didn't even stay in Boston after a certain number of years. And part of the reason probably was because I think on the one hand, you don't have either sport really taken off until baseball is already well, well, well established and the Robinson legend is already well established. So it was like, okay, we can't compete with that. But on the other hand, I think the other reason was because the players themselves didn't play along. One thing you know about Jackie is that Jackie played along. Jackie was like, I was the principal actor in Mr. Ricky's drama, and he wrote along. Those two went into the sunset together. You talk to Bill Russell, he'll say what he had to say about Red, but he had way, way, way more worse things to say about Boston. And you talk about Jim Brown, same thing. You know, Jim Brown may have things to say about Paul Brown. Jim Brown didn't like Paul Brown. They did not get along. So you didn't get the black actor to play along to be that sort of spear of lightning the way Branch Rickey had that with Jackie. And I think that's really significant. I think if Jim Brown or Bill Russell had both played along, maybe that story is different. But baseball had such a head start in terms of the national, as the national game anyway. No one cared about football, really. And also football, too. Baseball, the fact that baseball integrated before football because Jackie signed in 45, even though the NFL integrated on the actual black player playing was 46 with Kenny Washington and Marion Motley and those dudes. I think that just football just wasn't as popular. Just now, if all this is happening in, say, 1970, 1980, somewhere in there where football began to overtake baseball, different story, but football just... College football was more popular than pro football in 1945.
The other thing about Auerbach, too, and never forget, is he's also the man that looked up and was like, yeah, those teams didn't sell no tickets.
And they didn't sell. And that was the other thing.
Not only are we going to put some white dudes at the end of the bench where they don't matter, but if there is a halfway decent white dude in any draft, I will find a way
to take him.
And
that exists to this day. I mean, maybe a little less so now, but even in, you know, Danny was going to go out of his mind to get Frank Kaminsky. Frank Kaminsky.
And Jordan beat him to it. But the thing about it though is I'll always give this to Red though. Like Larry Bird and Kevin McHale, yeah, you do what you got to do to get those dudes. It didn't become a problem until he started getting the Michael Smiths of the world.
Until he got Michael Smith and Dino Roger, and they really couldn't play.
Yes, like, that's when it was like, hey, man, you're going a little too far on this, buddy. Game done changed.
Well, and let's not forget Larry, for all the things that Larry talked about with this, you know, Larry also, you know, he rode hard on Austin Crozier.
Yeah, he did. But you know what, though? He rode hard on Austin Crozier, and the big one was, look what happened to that roster after the brawl.
That's right.
When Bill Simmons is writing in columns that their motto should be, what can white do for you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that. He's like, look, man, I got to get people to come back. The block is hot. Y'all too hot right now. We need something else. But with the NFL, like the stories that Jim Brown was talking about with Paul Brown, and we'll, you know, farther in the book, we'll get into this, but it's pretty amazing, though, that Jim Brown was good enough in the 1960s to win a power struggle with the man who at that point might have been considered to be the best coach in the history of football.
That's right. But once again, this is the thing that Jim Brown, when you think about Jim Brown as a man, he understood his worth. And that's the thing that everyone keeps trying to get players to understand. You actually do have leverage here. You may not think you do, but you actually do have an enormous amount of power. And I think that in reading those sections, especially the sections where Paul Brown is given these speeches, and Mike was writing about how it felt like he was talking to a bunch of five-year-olds. This is the reason why I was like, yeah, I don't have any talent, but I also didn't have the mentality to be an athlete. I couldn't listen to that, and to be humiliated by and to be disposable. They really are humiliating paragraphs, but they're also illuminating in so many ways. You got to be of a certain mindset. And also the fact that when they're talking about the level of discipline that these men need, that these boys needed through sports and everything else, and how Paul Brown was one of these guys, you know, who would tell you how you were going to act. The racism in those sentences, just the actual code. You don't even need code in there. It really is powerful, and I think I'm answering my own question about whether or not you need to contextualize it or just let it sit there, because letting it sit there was plenty.
Yeah, no, I mean, some of those things just and when you listen to the like what the racism was, it was so basic, right? Like, you know, like this isn't it is a grand conspiracy that in a lot of ways just kind of operates and works on its own. But like the fact that he's always being compared to this one black dude they had at one time.
Speaking of players, that reminds me of whenever you would talk to Keith Van Horn, and everybody kept trying to compare Keith Van Horn to Larry Bird, and Keith Van Horn would say, no, my game's like Derek McKee.
Derek, of all people. By the way, his game was nothing like Derek McKee's, but that's what he wanted it to be.
I kind of patterned my game after, but we see that happen all the time, and that's the thing. It's like, I think when you're reading biography and you're thinking, how much are you reading the book to learn about the person and how much are you reading the book to sort of validate your own worldview. And this is how you can tell. It's like when I watch a movie, I decide, are you ready to ride with this director and what the director, where the director is going? If you're willing to take a ride with that director, chances are you're going to like the movie. If you're like, yeah, I don't really buy it, then it's probably not going to work. If you want to understand who Jim Brown is, this book is terrific. I mean, there's no way you can read the first 100 pages of this book and say, I don't know how he is the way he is. You read it and you say, I don't know how he could be any other way. Because the customs are so crushing. And so, okay, if you want to be like, whether it's, the personality like a Roy Campanella or a personality like a Jackie Robinson or a personality like a Jim Brown or a Bill Russell. These guys had to live in this. And how you navigated this was going to determine what kind of person you ended up being.
All right. That is our man, Howard Bryant. Check out The Heritage. This is a book that he put out last year. The Heritage came out, right?
Yes, sir.
Time flies, man. But absolutely, absolutely check that out. It is a great book. And this is our, we're doing the Right Time Book Club here. Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero by Mike Freeman. We're 100 pages in. Lonnie O'Neill will join us at the end of July to talk about this. Mike Freeman will join us in August. And my man, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, man, my pleasure.
Yes, our pretentious music to let you guys know. It is the next installment of the Right Time Book Club. We are reading Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero by Mike Freeman. Previously, we had Howard Bryant on to talk about the first third of the book. We'll have Mike Freeman, the author of the book, to talk about it next month. Before July, from The Undefeated, we have Lonnie O'Neill joining us here. And I thank you kindly for joining us here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I also feel like I'm about to tell myself to lower my voice. You have such a soft, delicate voice that makes you feel like I'm hollering.
I know. I'm going to have to put my hand up. Well, it's a book about Jim Brown, so if you're hollering, that probably works.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. And also, for those who don't know, Lonnie once took a shot at Henny with Marshawn Lynch.
I did. It started my career in sports writing, so... I was off to a bang.
Oh, they didn't tell you that in the manual, that it doesn't get started until you take your first shot at Henny? That's just the gang.
No, there was all kinds of things that was left out the manual with that one, but I'll save it for the memoir.
Yeah, no, one interesting thing you said before I brought you in, you were just like, I'm not like really a sports writer, right? Like that was your clear warning for me.
Right.
And I told you like, no, we're here. We're checking a slightly different box because I think it would be wildly inappropriate to talk about a book about Jim Brown or just talk about Jim in general without talking to a woman about this because I think, and I want to know what you thought about this idea, and Mike talks about it a little in the book, the title of it, the idea of the fierceness and the idea that Jim Brown is a hero, but the book does not position that as though the more onerous things that Jim has done in the middle don't matter. But it does get us to like an odd endpoint of sorts.
I think you're right, and what you're saying is that with him positioned as this hero, these things that he's alleged to have done and have done and gone through wasn't disqualifying, right? That we still are putting him in this stratosphere where he made all these strides in the sport, in civil rights, in the society, and that there was another side to him and these other things that he did are troublesome, and in a way, although they've been adjudicated, the culture is still wrestling with what we do with guys like this, and wrestling unevenly.
Yeah,
right?
Well, yeah. Part of why I wanted to talk about this book is I thought about this when Ali died. I was like, what in the world are we going to do when Jim Brown dies? Because there is no simplicity in dealing with this. And my leaning is that you don't dismiss the things that he did that were overwhelmingly positive. But he is an interesting case, and I think somewhat rare, where the things that he did that were good were of a fairly spectacular magnitude. And the things that he did that were bad were of the exact same magnitude on the other side.
Exactly. And it's gonna be a real challenge because in sports we want simplicity, right? You want that hero, that guy that runs, more than 1,000 yards and is an Iron Man and can get out there and shrug off the pain and do all of this. You want that kind of stoicism and uprightness to translate into what he does in his private life, the way he walks through the world. And it completely ignores the ways that one fuels the other. Maybe you don't get to be that fierce guy on the gridiron. You know, that's driven by something. That comes from somewhere. And so this notion that we can have it sort of kind of neat has been disproven over and over. And as you said, with Jim Brown, spectacular on the field and spectacularly awful in so many ways off the field, some of the things that he did.
And the tie that seems to bind it all, though, is a notion of masculinity.
Correct.
Right. Like it's for me, it's hard to separate, because what brings it all together is that in what some would consider the best and worst ways, this is a portrait of not necessarily what masculinity is, but certainly a very 1960s
performance of it.
Right. And a particularly black power 1960s form of masculinity, because tied to so many of those dudes is a startling level of misogyny.
Well, right. So it's a subset, right? You have masculinity, you have black masculinity, you have black power masculinity, which I would imagine would be different from, say, black artsy masculinity or something like that. But yes, that's the through line, right? So the notion that you are the, you know, this badass on the field, that you go out there and you're punishing men for trying to tackle you, you're dominating them, not just physically, but, you know, kind of bending them to your will, in terms of plays and strategy. And then, you know, off the field, you have these women, you starting with your wife, who he appeared to imply hadn't grown enough with him, right? That as his star got bigger, she wasn't able to evolve and to be more ambitious and to show other sides of her abilities and personalities. By the same token, why do I want a woman who's got her own thing? Why do I want a woman who's not just going to be there and wait for me and, you know, sort of support me? Why would I get married to someone like that? So it's a complete contradiction that doesn't even make any sense, cannot be embodied in one person. And got more and more sort of startling as you went along, as you read the book, as you're like, what? Did he really say that? Even in the 60s and 70s, this was really sort of strong and in a lot of cases ugly stuff.
Yeah, like the interview, I think it was in Ebony, that he did talking about his wife, where he talked about those things you mentioned, is that I need a woman that can step out and to do all these things. And I was like, yo, you know she can read this, right?
Right.
Like, you know, her friends are, you know, her mama's going to see this, right? Everybody got Ebony, bro.
Right. It's, you know, you're going to go down to the barbershop. It's still going to be there probably. And the thing that was so startling about that too is I'm looking, I had to go back, flip through the pages and look again at the date. I was like, yo, they were still married.
Yes.
Like, how are you putting this out in public and how are you sort of feeling entitled to be able to say these things, which was interesting because it was all about entitlement. Well, not even entitlement, domination. Like he got what he could, you know, take by force. And as his career progressed and he was just given more ground, more of a platform. He just seemed to be able to decide that, hey, I'm going to talk about women. I'm going to talk about Hollywood. I'm going to, use these as an extension of my dominance in sports. And it didn't work as well, nearly as well as when he was talking about sports and civil rights and those kinds of things.
I also thought that you pointed out just there something I thought that was strange in the way he handled it, which was, you want a woman to have all these ambitions while also wanting her to not do anything, which I don't know how that works. Like, I don't know what room was there for your woman to grow when you was gone all the time, right? And she's here with these kids.
Right, exactly. And especially since she had to at least subconsciously know that while you're saying you want her to grow, you really only want that so much, right? Because then that would take away her ability to be there 24/7. With you on command, on demand, and just be there raising your kids while you're off doing whatever you want with whomever you want in public, with no discretion. It was just a lot. I also found it kind of strange though that I didn't get any sense of his wife until really this little middle third of the book, right? It was well past page 150 that I even read her name. And I thought that was strange. There were allusions earlier that he was married, you know, he'd be in the car with his wife. But I was like, oh, yo, who is this woman, you know, who's so one-dimensional, you know, that she barely merits a mention in the first, you know, half of the book.
Yeah, it seems like he must not have gotten but so much access to the family, because you don't really hear that much from the kids. Kids, by the way, that, you know, look at Jim and say, yo, we didn't know our dad either, right? Right?
Right.
Right, as this growing woman was supposed to be out here. Jim ain't hugging his kids, Jim's not doing any of this stuff, which again gets us to this weird notion of, like, being a man.
Right.
And it also seemed that Jim seemed to be doing a lot of figuring out how to be a man by guessing, right? Because all the men in his life were people who were facilitating his athletic dreams, it seems, at least.
He was trying on these different clothes, these different shoes, these different man suits, and a lot of them just didn't fit, or they fit for being a star football player and the kind of leadership and determination that's required there. But they didn't fit in terms of having functional relationships with the people who are supposed to be the closest to you in your life. There's a not just a fear of intimacy, almost a contempt for it. And so, right, the how am I going to do this? Presumably, he would want to be different from his own absent father, but he ended up replicating the very thing that he grew up with in that absence. And, you know, that trickles down through the kids. You know, later on in the book, I know the author talks more extensively about his second family. And apparently, you know, that goes a little bit differently. He's a little bit more available. But, man, when I was reading this part, I was just like, ooh, this is just rough. These are just flat characters who don't even seem to share in that celebration and that glory and all his achievements.
You know, and you mentioned the second family. I saw Jim 2 or 3 years ago in Miami. I think it was 2 years ago I saw him, and he was with his wife. And, you know, he's older now. I think he did hit 80. And
so yeah, he's walking. He's 83.
Yeah, like he's walking with a cane now. And when you mentioned intimacy, it hit me is that that's kind of what's left at this point for a man in that position in life. And I wonder how that goes for him as he, you know, because this book was published about 10, 12 years ago, how it goes for him after that fact now, because all that's left in life for him is intimate moments and all the, for someone to care for an 83-year-old man who can't quite get around and requires as much as Jim probably requires, that's all you two have.
Right, right. I think you bring up something really important. She's Generation X, so she's essentially, his wife is essentially caring for an elderly spouse. And, you know, I guess he would have had to learn to be intimate because in so many ways he's got to be dependent on her now in ways that he was wholly unaccustomed to being when he was younger. It's good that you know, he hit 80 and he's still getting around and, you know, we've written about him. He has still his AmeriCan program and out there trying to make a difference. But, yeah, wow, what you have is your wife. What you have are your children. You're not on this heavy-duty speaking circuit traveling the country getting all these accolades. So you have these intimate moments, and you better have gotten better at them. Otherwise, what's the choice? To die alone?
Right. And this portion of the book also gets into, well, just maybe the, if you ask people one thing they know about Jim Brown specifically, I think they'd have a harder time pointing at one particular football moment and would immediately get to the woman he threw off a balcony, which yeah, I did right. not realize. We talked about this coming in where you said that for a lot of people, the belief was that it was Raquel Welch that he had thrown off the balcony.
You know, I don't know if that was just me. I don't know if that was just the rumor in Chicago or if I just heard it wrong. But somehow in my young mind, I conflated football, Raquel Welch, and balcony. But all of it just added up to a picture of an incredibly singular figure in the popular culture that folks were wrestling with, right? He was past his playing days and prime, when I was young and was hearing about him as this actor, as this friend of Richard Pryor, as this man who threw women off balconies. And so it was just incredibly complex and conflated. And you made a point earlier about what are they going to say about him. Those things were difficult to deconstruct, to unpack even then, right? Like, even when you knew less and there was, you know, there were fewer words about him and no social media and any of that, he was still, people didn't know how to process those things going together. And I think, again, folks want simplicity. So he's a star who just, you know, had to knock around his woman a little bit. But the balcony thing was an extremity.
Yeah, and it's interesting that that's just a sentence. Like, and, you know, and I say this as someone who has received Jim and had, you know, it's a process in figuring out what I think about all of this. Mm-hmm. You know, like what I thought in 2006, for example, is not necessarily the same as what I think now. But that really was just a sentence. Oh, yeah, there was that one time that he threw a woman off a balcony.
Right.
Because we have to keep going to get to the other stuff.
Right.
And I think it speaks a lot to how we talk about women or how we feel about women as a society, because even white people are just going past this. It's like, okay, it's just another sentence in it. Like, with this revolutionary type of figure who was trying to dominate, like, economically, right? Who was going for, I guess, a self-sufficiency argument that can be easy for a lot of white people to support because it takes responsibility away from them, but also seizing power back from people. And he threw this woman off a balcony. Now, granted, it was a black woman, so maybe that affects the way that it was received, but he throws this woman off the balcony and it's just a sentence.
Right. And I want to go back to something you just said, even white people, I would say especially white people, because the things that he was bringing to the popular culture, to people's bottom lines, right? The value add of a Jim Brown on your football team and then in your movies to add this exoticism or, you know, whatever. And then the fact that it's politically palatable for him to say, you know, up by your bootstraps, we need all this economic self-determination without languaging. I'm sure he recognized it, and he did say it in various parts, but the structural inequalities that are just baked in the system. But that uplift message was something they could get behind. So especially white people who have, you know, the mainstream culture has its own long and, intimate relationship with violence against women. So yeah, that got completely glossed over in some ways, as you said, just as a sentence, just as an aside, as a comma of apposition. Oh, you know, Jim Brown, great football player, Hollywood star, civil rights activist. He threw that woman off the balcony that time. And then him and Richard Pryor are real good friends,
right?
You know? Yeah.
And it even as in the last, you know, 2-3 years or so, we have reckoned with some of these matters a bit differently. And when Jim did something that was wildly unpopular among black people, which is his support for
Nixon.
Donald Trump.
Oh.
Yeah, because he did Nixon too, right?
Right.
But even after that, it still remained a sentence. Like, I'm not even saying that people necessarily care that much about violence against women, but we will throw this stuff out as an excuse against people we don't like all the time. Mm-hmm. It didn't come up then. And also in reading this book, something that comes up kind of not, I don't know if subtly is the right way to put it, but relationships with underage women.
How about that?
Are pretty mentioned like more than once. Getting one pregnant, I know, comes up in the course of the book. And even then, there's still sentences in the larger Jim Brown narrative. And it is fascinating that it has existed as such.
It is, isn't it? And stuff that, again, would be disqualifying for others as we're having these reconsiderations and these reckonings with people's past, with, you know, Al Franken who kissed too many people or something like that. You have this whole ass celebrity with this enormously troublesome backstory and complicated history. As you said, that includes underage women, which the woman he's alleged to have gotten pregnant and completely denied, went to court about, Brenda Ayers,
right,
in the book, and then admitted, you know, later that, yeah, he did, in fact, father a child with this woman.
And in fact, woman is a stretch because I think she was 15.
I think, well, when she went to court, she was 18.
Oh, right.
And there was no mention of her prior to 18. So who knows when, you know, all the freaky haps are alleged to have happened.
Yes.
But it's part of what is problematic about a reconsideration and this moment in that it is so unevenly applied, right? And so we don't have a template for judging someone like a Jim Brown because we can say all these other things about him that are not exclusively athletic, but about what he meant to the culture and that subset we were talking about earlier, manhood and black power. So that perhaps renders him more Teflon, right? That's an untouchable thing. White commentators, maybe even in this reconsideration, don't want to leave themselves open to charges of racism or just not getting it, right? And, you know, black folks, in some ways and in some quarters, haven't reached a place where we feel healed enough and secure enough in our person and secure enough in these streets as in our citizenship to go after someone who so clearly stood up for us. So those contradictions, those are tough to wrestle with.
Yeah, and I wish and I think about this very often just in this business that it not be such a requirement that we can like put together a one sheet on somebody, right? Right. Like that we can try to sum them up in one sentence because I think I long ago made terms with the fact that good things happen to bad people all the time. And I also came to terms with the fact that like, Jim is so wildly impressive, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even if I don't want it to make it seem like I'm saying separate all the bad stuff, but like, if Jim Brown were to walk into a room and you talk to Jim Brown and like, you look at the football clips or just look at the clips of him talking or just look at him standing or just look at him in a suit, like all of these things, you know that's the dude that you know the second that he walks in the room. He doesn't have to talk loud. And when he has things to say, there are things that are worth hearing. Like he is unquestionably an impressive figure. And you can also be an impressive figure who has done awful things. And I think that where people find guys like him to be, the word we like to use is compelling, is, yeah, it's really compelling that this guy could be so impressive but also do awful things, except these two things at once, it's kind of like they're not related, but also they're not separate. Like, you know, it's just, if we need to make him simple, this is going to be hard. If we can take these things, beating women as an individual thing and his fight for civil rights as its own individual thing, this actually gets pretty simple.
Right. Right. Well, and separating them, I think you're right, is the wrong thing to do. They're all blended up together. They all make the person in the same way that, you know, George Washington and the, apocryphal story of his cherry tree or his heroics on the battlefield. He also had a mouthful of false teeth that he got from one of his enslaved people.
Right.
Right?
By the way, that is not an exaggeration for the people who heard that are like, you must be crazy. No, they would take the teeth out the slaves' mouths and
that?
Put them into masses.
Who were presumably still using them.
Yeah, that's right.
I feel like they didn't give, you know, permission or, you know, they didn't say, hold up, I got lunch coming up or something like that, that wasn't a power that they had. Right. And the answer is, I don't care, you know, tote that barge, bail that hay, whatever. But point being, something we went back to earlier, these kinds of reconsiderations, they're uneven. They get applied to some people and not to others, for some things and not to other things, for some things for some people, for other things to other people. And so blending this stuff together is the only way moving forward that we're going to be able to make sense out of all of this. And it won't be a one sheet, right? There'll be volumes. And that's all of us. If we took a microscope to our lives and, you know, his was an outsized life. His was is a hyperbolic life. And so you're going to have to make peace with the fact that you can't make an easy peace with some of these things.
And I tell you, that Fox News obituary when Jim Brown dies, boy, it is going to be, you know it's coming. It's got to come now. It's on the way.
They're writing it now. Listening to us as we speak.
It is on the way. The tweet has already been drafted.
Like, how about that?
Everything is ready. That is Lanae O'Neal. Check her out at theundefeated.com. I thank you so much for joining us here in studio for this. That was very kind of you.
Thank you so much, Bomani. This is great.
All right. It is the finale for us here on the Right Time Book Club. Thank you so much for everybody who's read, everybody who's sending questions, everybody who has contributed. You can check us out again at the hashtag The Right Time Book Club in case you want to catch up. And our book this summer was Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero by Mike Freeman. And with that in mind, joining us today on the show is the author of the book, Mike Freeman. Mike, man, I want to tell you first why I chose this book. I read the book when it came out, and I used it when I taught a class at Duke a few years ago on the Black Athlete in America. And I found it to be very interesting and very even-handed. But part of why I wanted to revisit this book was with our changing attitudes in public about matters, particularly about like violence against women and domestic, you know, domestic violence, that Jim Brown is, we've known this about Jim Brown for a long time and just taken it as part of the Jim Brown story. But it was kind of interesting to read back now as our sensibilities have kind of changed, but this Jim Brown story stays the same, you know?
Well, first, I want to thank you for doing this. A lot of us appreciate it. It's really just terrific that you do this. So thank you, first of all. And 100% correct. It's changed. Our sensibilities have changed dramatically. And you know, the one thing, looking back on it, you know, the book has the word hero in it. I don't know if I would use that word now. In fact, I probably wouldn't. In fact, I'm sure I wouldn't. That's how much I think things have changed. And you bring up a good point that we always knew this about Brown. And this goes to, I think, the fault of men and how myopic we can be, and even men who think they have some sort of understanding of domestic violence, who think of themselves as good men, who think of themselves as men that sympathize and empathize and would protect a woman in those circumstances. But even men like us who think of ourselves that way have huge holes because we're men, because we're taught by society a certain way. And even if you are open-minded and think a certain way and are progressive, you still have a huge hole. So in the book, I talk about why I call him a hero, but it's looking back on it, it's just there's no way I should have done that. And everything that's happened since I wrote that book has dramatically altered our society, altered how we think of things, and altered how I think of how I've written this book. I love revisiting it because I look back on it, and you rarely get times in life to just sort of look back on something and say, I'm going to correct this. I'm going to think of it this way. I'm going to think of it differently. And that's what I've done with this book. So I'm appreciative of you for that. But there are parts of it that I look at and I go, oh, I would have done that very differently. And there's very few books I've written where I've done that, or columns, or there's parts of my life I like to revisit, but there's very few books and things I've written that I revisit because I'm like, this is how I feel, and it's sincere, it's from the heart, but this is a huge one of those times where I wish I did not use that word. I don't think he deserves it. And I think there are aspects of him that are absolutely great. But, I mean, and just real quick, like, if you look at Jim Brown's life, you know, we're talking about the one domestic violence part of it, and there's another part of it that is just, to me, just looking back, is just staggering. I mean, Jim Brown goes to Syracuse and is a very openly proud African-American man who was, when he goes to Syracuse, he was told that he couldn't date white women while he was there. He played lacrosse. He talked about racism openly to people on campus, to other people. He was not shy in any way about being a proud African-American man. He goes to the Browns in the late 50s, early 60s. The NFL still has quotas, unspoken of, but they were locked in place, that you can only have 3 to 5 black players on your teams. Brown railed against that publicly, not privately. Not, he did it publicly, and he helped change that policy very slowly. He goes to Hollywood. He's the first black action hero. He fights for the rights and talks, again, openly about black people not having the opportunities in the movies. He goes to L.A. He brokers peace between gangs. He probably saved, not underestimating in any way, he probably saved hundreds of thousands of lives. The gang members were like, we're going to listen to Jim Brown. We're going to listen to him. He brokered peace at his house. He'd have him at his house. I look at the Jim Brown now, and I can't even recognize him. He doesn't look anything like the guy that spent years of my life studying and writing about and think of him a certain way. It's, I think what years do is they sometimes they change us for the better, sometimes they change us for the worse. Brown is just all over the place. I mean, he's hard to really just put into any kind of category. He's always been that way, but especially now. I mean, this is the picture of him with Kanye West in the White House is just staggering. I mean, I can't, to people listening, I can't emphasize enough how dramatically different that is from 30, 40 years ago with Jim Brown. So this book sort of, to me, it just sort of, it's one of the things, it's sort of an example of how we all change and how times change and how some things sort of stay the same and some things sort of, we just don't recognize them anymore. And this is one of those examples. I mean, it's just crazy some of the stuff that's happened since I wrote that book, but this is one of those examples.
You know, the term hero, and you did explain in the book, like, because it was a very provocative thing to do in the title, but I also thought it was very intellectually compelling at the time that it came out because, like I've said for a while now, I don't know what we're going to do as media when Jim Brown dies because there's no simple encapsulation. Like, there's no paragraph that you can write that spells this out. And so at the time of the writing, and I also thought it was interesting to me in reading back the book, having not read it in about 10 years, the tone that you took when talking about the things, like the violence against women and those things, you didn't pull any punches. Like, you didn't spare him. It wasn't as though you wrote it and were just like, ah, yeah, so he did this one thing, but yeah, whatever. Like, I thought you were very direct about it, but we did treat that as just kind of part of the narrative because that's what we've always done when it came to Jim Brown. And I don't know, like, if Jim Brown came around now, I don't think it would be possible to do that in that way, which would then be interesting because what would we then say about the unquestionably great works that he did?
That's a really, really smart point. And if Jim Brown came around now, I don't know. Well, when he arrived on the scene, especially when he got to the Browns, obviously it's a dramatically different America. And he was one of those guys that saw all the racism and was like, screw this, I'm fighting it. He fought it very publicly. Not just with words, but with deeds. He started the it was later called the Black Economic Union. That picture, that iconic picture with him and then Lew Alcindor, a bunch of the black star athletes at the time. They were defending Muhammad Ali's decision not to go into the draft. That picture, people should go Google if they don't know what I'm talking about. It's a beautiful picture, but it's all because of Jim Brown. Jim Brown organized the whole thing. He got all the black athletes there to defend Muhammad Ali. That is a very powerful thing. All the things he did like that were very, very powerful. But I don't know. It's different times. So it's hard to just go to draw a straight line. But I don't think that Jim Brown with his domestic violence history would be able to exist. He wouldn't have the power to do it, which is ironic because we didn't give domestic violence enough weight, and in some ways we still don't, but especially when he was coming of age, and not giving the domestic violence that weight allowed him to be powerful, allowed him to be a very powerful, strong black man. And now we do give domestic violence that weight, as we should. We condemn people who commit it, as we should, but that also would weaken the Jim Brown today, and it has. So when you bring up that really excellent point about how we describe him and how we write about him and what that core graph or couple of graphs would look like, it would be all over the place because there were parts of him that were absolutely great and there were parts of him that were absolutely dreadful and in between. Most of us are like that, not to those extremes, but most human beings do some things that they're not proud of and things that they're proud of and things they do really well and things they don't do well. But he was those extremes on both. I mean, he was polar opposite, and he would do some remarkably brilliant, smart, aggressive things to help people of color, and then he would do things to undermine that. But I don't think that Jim Brown today would have the standing to do that with his domestic violence history. So it would be a completely different Jim Brown today. But he came along at the perfect time for him. He came along at the perfect time for sports, professional sports, for the civil rights movement. He was an athlete who understood how to use his power of an athlete to to better the positions or try to better the positions of people of color. And he understood that and he embraced it. So it was a different time for him, no question.
And it's all wrapped up in his refusal, his uncompromising nature, his refusal to apologize, all of that, which leads to the positive things, but of course then compounds the negative. Like I was thinking about this when Don Newcomb, former pitcher of the Dodgers, died not too long ago. And I read something about him that I did not realize is that he had savagely beaten his wife while he was a player. He was also a raging alcoholic. But you could find the quotes of him saying, I was a drunk and an awful man then, and I did awful things. Like, and that's not the deepest right. sentence in the world, but that's kind of the sentence that people need to hear. And that's something that Jim Brown could very, especially at 80 years old at this point, could very easily say is, I did some awful things, but he has denied all of them.
And I don't think there's, and I read probably 99% of the stories ever written on him. I spent years, that was so much of the research, just reading stuff about him and about some of these really horrific incidents. And I don't, if I remember correctly, I don't think I ever saw him apologize once on about any of that. Going back to decades ago when he had these issues, he was on trial in Cleveland once for domestic violence, for assault. Going back all the way back then, I don't think I ever saw him say, you know, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. It's of all the strengths he has, that's one of his greatest weaknesses. And I think it's a weakness of your person who doesn't have introspection, look back at your life. And if you're a public figure, publicly say that what I did was wrong. And when asked about it, that's an inherent weakness to me. You need to have introspection. You're not going to be perfect. And you look back at your life and you try to get it better and make things better. He didn't do that. He's unapologetic in every way. Some of that is beneficial. Some of that is really bad. I mean, you know, you do some of the things he did, you just say, I shouldn't have done that. I'm sorry, but he will not do that. I don't think he's ever done that. I may be missing something, but I don't think he's ever done that. And he never will. I don't think till his dying day will he ever do that. It's just not in his nature. He sees it as weakness. And more than anything, what he wanted to be about was dominating the culture, dominating the era, dominating the football field, dominating the locker room, dominating women. That was who he was. He is. He's unapologetic for it. It's one of his great weaknesses, but that's who he has been his entire life. The one consistent part of him, we talk about all these different ups and downs, these different polar opposites. The one consistent part of him is just not apologizing and just moving forward and just bowling people over. So that's who he's always been, and I think that's who he'll always be.
And that's juxtaposed against his belief in his own honesty. Right. Because that's what he's one of those guys that brags, you know, whose honesty is his big thing. But the thing he seems not to be able to be honest about is himself.
And one of the things about him that I always found really interesting was just how he took what he did on the field and just took it off the field in every aspect of his life. Like on the field, he really enjoyed just beating the crap out of people. And people had taken their best shots at him and him keep going. And he took just vicious shots. If you look at some of the tapes, he would the dudes were just were so much smaller than him, but it would be like four or five guys taking their best shots, play after play after play, sometimes five or six, seven, eight shots in one run. It was crazy. So his thought was, that's how I'm going to be off the field. Off the field, take all the shots you want of me. He could be a little thin-skinned sometimes, but mostly he was tough. And he decided, I'm going to just be tough, and no one's going to get to me. I'm not going to apologize. I'm not going to do anything but be tough. That's who I am. And on the field, it obviously worked really well. Off the field, it worked in certain aspects, and off the field, it didn't work in certain aspects. Some of it was very troubling off the field.
Now, one thing I was always curious about, when you were writing the book, what did you come across in the process that really had you like, wow, I had no idea of this until I started doing the research?
It was the Hollywood stuff. When you look at movies now, there's like people of color that are stars all over the place. I mean, people will inherently know this, but it was just when he came about, it was just stark, the lack of people of color in Hollywood, not just on screen, obviously, but off screen, how racist Hollywood still was when he got to it. And the interracial kiss he had with Raquel Welch, one of the first, it was a huge deal. But it was what made it really significant, what made Jim Brown in Hollywood really significant, was just how he was the first black action hero, but he was just the first guy that would openly and constantly talk about race. And, you know, like you talk about race now, people say, why are you always going to talk about race? Shut up about race. And you're sort of, people try to back you down and keep you from talking about it. And then, I mean, it was even more, much, much more hostile, and he didn't care. And he would do interviews with Hollywood media and talk about the inequities in Hollywood. And the other thing is he made a lot of movies. He made a good dozen movies. And one of the things that really surprised me the most is they were all big time profitable. He made movies and people went to see them and people went to watch them. And a lot of people did, and they were profitable. That's why he was able to keep making them. He was able to just, people really liked him. They liked who he was on screen. They liked his personality. Like, he was a tough guy. So that the Hollywood part of it really, really surprised me more than anything, because I knew he was in Hollywood. I didn't know it was to that extent. I didn't know he was that well liked by particularly African American moviegoers. I didn't know any of that, and that really, really stunned me because it was very extensive. So I didn't know about any of that. I mean, some of it I didn't know about, a lot of it, and he was a very, very powerful player in Hollywood at the time.
You know, the Hollywood stuff is tied to an NFL story that's here, you know, out now with Andrew Luck retiring as suddenly as he did, which was shocking. But can you give people perspective that you got in doing the book of just how shocking and audacious it was to be like, hey, man, I'm over here making the Dirty Dozen. I'm going to just stay.
If you take Andrew Luck and multiply by like 1,000, that's what it was. In the NFL itself, in the league itself, people were just absolutely stunned. He was dominating the league. He was young. He had at least another 5 years. No one saw it coming. He didn't really tell anyone about it, really. He didn't tell the Browns about it until very late. And he was as dominant a force in the history of the league as you will ever see. And he left at the very height of it. And he went... And when he retired, he's shooting The Dirty Dozen, the movie, and he's standing. There's a scene of him where he's talking about retiring, and he's standing in front of this prop tank. And he's talking about, I don't need football. I save up my money. This is bigger. I can have more influence doing this. And at the time, that wasn't really – people thought that was just dumb. Like, why are you leaving the sport? Football wasn't obviously what it is now, but it was still very influential. And the way he was dominating it so much, people thought going to the movies, like, that was stupid. And, of course, he was, because he's a very smart guy, he was two steps ahead of people. He saw how he used his influence in football to change things and to draw attention to race relations. He thought he could do the same in Hollywood, just on a bigger scale. And he was also ahead of his time in terms of the physicality, the toll it took on his body. He was, before people were even talking about this stuff, talking about concussions, head injuries, the long-term effects of football, and he just didn't want to do it anymore. And that way he was, in a lot of ways, ahead of his time, but that way also he was ahead of his time. He understood and studied what it did to the body. He just really took it to heart and just said, I'm going to go make movies. And at the time, it was just, I mean, what happened with Andrew Luck now is nothing compared to then. It was a huge national story then, all across every aspect of the culture, from news to sports to Hollywood to everything. So it was a monumental thing what he did.
And if people thought that Andrew Luck, they were entitled to Andrew Luck entertaining them, God knows what they thought they were entitled to from Jim Brown.
I got to say, I'm rarely shocked anymore. I'm sure you're not either. Like, we've seen a lot of stuff. The entitlement people have towards Luck is just like that. It just stunned me. I know I shouldn't be, You know, I know I shouldn't be stunned. I was still, like, people booing him, people saying, and on it, I'll just be blunt. Usually I see that with African-American athletes, how people think they own them.
Right.
This was one of the first time I saw it with a white athlete. And it was still, I've seen it before all the time, it was still stunning to watch people think that they have some sort of control or should have some sort of control over the life of an athlete. Like, you watch them and you see them on Sunday and you think you control them. And if they don't do what you want, then they're mad at you. That, I mean, if you really just think about that in a vacuum, it's really unbelievably arrogant and stupid. But that's how a lot of people think. And Brown, again, when he did it, there were a lot of really angry fans. You can imagine some of the things they were saying about Brown, and he didn't care. And he just walked away, and he didn't care. And he, you know, in retrospect, he's still considered by a lot of people the best player of all time, and he still has these other marks in the culture and society and history. So he obviously made the right decision because it's what he wanted to do. It's his body. But he also made a really smart decision because he had impacts on multiple fronts. He never saw himself as just as a football player. He saw himself as someone that could change things or talk about changing things. And he was able to do that in Hollywood too. So it was, in the end, it was a smart decision.
And, you know, to kind of wrap this up, I wanted, at first my thought was to ask questions. So, like, what do we say about Jim Brown now? But I wonder if the ultimate lesson is we got to learn to say more things about people, because we're, like we said before, we're not going to get that core paragraph that explains what he is. Like, this is a guy who, in retrospect, when it comes time to sum this all up, is just going to be like, hey, go ahead and have a seat. This might take a while.
Really, really good point. And I think the way to answer that is, in our profession, sometimes nuance is missing. Sometimes depth is missing. With Brown, you're going to have to sort of say some really uncomfortable things while pointing out all the great things. There are going to be multiple fronts to write about with him, and have been for decades. There will continue to be that way. He helped define the National Football League. He helped define what it meant to be a black actor. He helped define those things. He also helped define, in a lot of ways, or point out our weakness when it comes to addressing domestic violence. I think that's changed a lot. So now we're armed, especially men, with these sensibilities. So when you look at his legacy, the sensibilities that we didn't have 20 years ago, we have now. It will cast his legacy in a completely different light, and there will be very, very good things and very, very bad things. And your point is really well taken, because that's okay. I mean, not the domestic violence part obviously isn't okay, but our addressing the weaknesses of human beings is what you should do when you're doing these type of evaluations of a guy. I mean, this is how you address a multidimensional person, because most people are that way. They're multidimensional. He's very much that way. So it's okay to talk about, and encouraging to talk about, his weaknesses, because it humanizes him and it humanizes us. But it that's going to be his legacy. His legacy is going to be very, very complicated, and some of it's going to be very ugly, and some of it's going to be really remarkable. But this is who he is. This is who he's always been. This is Jim Brown. This is the guy who helped define a league, helped define the 60s and 70s of Hollywood, helped broker peace between gangs, helped do all these different things, and also had this really ugly side. So all of that's going to be accounted for. We'll all be talking about that forever. So all of it comes into play, and that's the way it should be.
All right, that is Mike Freeman. Check him out at Bleacher Report. He is also the author of Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero. That's the book we did this summer, and I think we all had a great time going through it. I mean, like, we did the book club last summer, and it was good, but I think this led to a depth of discussion with all the people that we had on. So I thank you for contributing that piece of work, sir.
I thank you. Really appreciate what you're doing, and you're just one of the most talented guys in the business, so keep doing what you're doing, and really appreciate you.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate that. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us here on The Right Time. I do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Remember to subscribe to The Right Times wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater, and we'll talk to you in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear. More driven.